Today's episode is sponsored by Tego. For most of us, indemnity insurance is one of our biggest costs of practice. But when was the last time you took a look at the coverage and compared your premium with others?
Many of us are still with the same insurer we joined in med school or intern year. Thousands of doctors have made the switch to Tego and benefited from their personalised approach to pricing. You will also get an extra 2 months free in your first year.
If you are new to private practice, you might even qualify for 4 years of discounted premiums.
Tego offers competitive premiums, quality cover, and 24/7 support backed by top medico-legal advisors.
Get a free quote and discover why thousands of doctors are insured by Tego by visiting tego.com.au.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Deep Breaths, a podcast covering topics related to the Part 2 anaesthetic exam.
I'm Dr. Kate Steele.
And I'm Dr. Kate McCrossan.
And today's episode is Hungry Like the Wolf, where we'll discuss GLP-1 receptor agonists and perioperative fasting. In this podcast, we represent our own views and not those of our employers or ANSCA.
Ozempic and other glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists are very topical in both medical literature and in pop culture at the moment for a variety of reasons. Today, we're going to take a close look at these medications and how they impact our anaesthetic practice.
Let's start with a brief overview of some very relevant physiology, which will absolutely assist in understanding how these medications work. As I'm sure you're all aware, the process of maintaining glucose homeostasis involves a complex interplay of several different hormones. We won't cover everything here, just the physiology that's relevant to the GLP-1 agonists.
After eating a meal, there are lots of different hormones that are involved with gastric acid secretion and feedback mechanisms. But one specific hormone that is released when food moves from the stomach to the small intestine is glucagon-like peptide 1. This hormone is released from L cells within the wall of the intestine in response to the presence of nutrients within the small intestinal lumen. These nutrients trigger a number of nutrient-specific mechanisms within the L cell that include substrate uptake via transporters, as well as activation of G protein-coupled receptors. Ultimately, after detecting the presence of food, specifically hexose and fat, within the SI lumen, the L cells secrete GLP-1, which then travels in the blood to bind to specific GLP-1 receptors in pancreatic beta cells, pancreatic ducts, gastric mucosa, kidney, lung, heart, skin, immune cells, and the hypothalamus.
The main effect of GLP-1 occurs at pancreatic beta cells, where it increases the sensitivity of these cells to glucose. This increased sensitivity in turn results in more glucose-dependent insulin release, and this ultimately results in the transport of glucose into cells within the body. Other gastrointestinal effects of this hormone include a slowing of gastric emptying, inhibition of inappropriate post-meal glucagon release, and a reduction in food intake by making us feel sated. GLP-1 has a very short half-life of only 1 to 2 minutes and is metabolized by the enzyme dipeptylpeptidase 4, or DPP4. So unless its secretion continues, its effects are relatively short-lived.
Knowing what we know now about how endogenous GLP-1 is produced, secreted, and metabolized, it's not hard to see how GLP-1 receptor agonists would be useful in managing type 2 diabetes. In patients with type 2 diabetes, the process by which GLP-1 is secreted binds to pancreatic beta cells, increases their sensitivity to circulating blood glucose, and thus triggers greater release of insulin can become blunted or even absent. It has been observed, though, that GLP-1 agonist medications can revive insulin secretion, and it is this mechanism that assists in glycemic control. Additional benefits that have been observed with GLP-1 agonism treatment in diabetes are the observed delayed gastric emptying and stopping the production and the release of glucagon from pancreatic alpha cells if blood sugar levels are high. Additionally, these medications also decrease pancreatic beta cell apoptosis while promoting their proliferation. In patients with diabetes, this medication has been found to reduce HbA1c by about 1% and to reduce all-cause mortality.
Additional benefits from GLP-1 receptor agonist medications have been found on the cardiovascular system. We see lowering of both the systolic and diastolic blood pressures, as well as lowering of total cholesterol. We also see an improvement in left ventricular ejection fraction, myocardial contractility, coronary blood flow, cardiac output, and endothelial function while reducing myocardial infarction size and lowering the overall risk of a myocardial event. And we'd be remiss if we didn't address the significant weight loss observed with the use of this medication. The increased satiety and reduction in appetite seen with administration of GLP-1 receptor agonists is through their direct effect at the hypothalamus.
In Australia, there are three injectable GLP-1 receptor agonists on the market for the management of diabetes mellitus. Dulaglutide, brand name Trulicity, semaglutide, brand name Ozempic, and liraglutide, brand name Saxenda, are all administered weekly. A fourth medication, tirzepatide, brand name Mounjaro, is also available and is a combined GLP-1 receptor agonist as well as a glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, or GIP agonist. In New Zealand, there are only two GLP-1 receptor agonists approved for use at this time. Dulaglutide, which we've already mentioned and is taken weekly, and liraglutide, or brand name Victoza, which is administered daily. At the time of recording, orally administered GLP-1 receptor agonists are not available in Australia or New Zealand.
It should also be said that GLP-1 receptor agonists are also approved for use in weight loss management. In Australia, these medications include semaglutide, brand name Wegovy, and liraglutide, brand name Saxenda. And in New Zealand, only liraglutide, brand name Saxenda and not Victoza, is approved for weight management.
Okay, so now that we understand how these drugs work and appreciate that these drugs cause a delay in gastric emptying, how does this affect perioperative fasting? Well, in a nutshell, there are no clear Australian or New Zealand consensus-based or evidence-based guidelines addressing what we as anaesthetists should do when managing patients taking GLP-1 receptor agonists perioperatively. In fact, at the time of recording this episode, only the American Society of Anesthesiologists have published consensus-based guidelines surrounding the perioperative management of GLP-1 receptor agonists, and we'll go on to talk about this soon.
As it stands, ANSCA has a professional document, PG07A, created in 2023 and specifically laying out perioperative fasting guidelines within Appendix A. We have a link to this document in our show notes if you're interested. The recommendations for patients older than 16 years are as follows. First, solid food of a low calorific nature, for example, a light meal, may be allowed up to 6 hours prior to anaesthesia. Two, clear liquids. For elective and selected emergency procedures, clear liquids should be encouraged up to 2 hours prior to anaesthesia. While sip till send is an emerging practice gaining increased acceptance, a safe, acceptable rate of drinking clear liquids in elective situations is a maximum of 200 ml per hour with a maximum volume of 400 ml of clear liquid 2 hours prior to the procedure. This does not appear to be associated with an increase in risk of regurgitation or aspiration.
3. Carbohydrate-containing clear liquids are becoming increasingly available for enhanced recovery after surgery pathways. Although there are more benefits than harm reported, they may not be recommended in all situations. 4. Sips of liquid and medication administration. Prescribed medications may be taken with a sip, 30 ml for an adult, of water up to 20 minutes prior to anaesthesia. The 30 ml includes the volume required for any other liquid medication such as sodium citrate.
5. Enteral feeds should generally be continued in intubated intensive care patients until procedural transfer unless airway, thoracic or abdominal procedures are to be performed, in which case they should be ceased for 6 hours. 6. Medications that decrease gastric secretion and or acidity and or those that increase gastric emptying should be considered for patients with an increased risk of gastric regurgitation.
We're also going to address the children's fasting guidelines within this document, as it's worth being aware that GLP-1 receptor agonists are able to be prescribed to children aged 10 and above. For the record, we won't be addressing the guidelines relevant to children under 10. The guidelines for children up to 16 years of age are as follows. Prolonged fasting time should be avoided, and healthy children encouraged to drink clear liquids, which include water, pulp-free juice and carbohydrate drinks, of 3 ml per kilo per hour up to 1 hour before anaesthesia. And solid food is allowed up to 6 hours prior to anaesthesia.
Now, there are some additional caveats that are important to keep in mind when implementing the ANSCA fasting guidelines. The first is that this fasting guideline may not apply to individual patients deemed at increased risk of perioperative regurgitation or vomiting. The second is that where reducing risk for individual patients requires deviating from these recommendations, doctors should exercise their discretion over fasting times versus the risk of dehydration or metabolic effects of regurgitation. Similarly, adjustments of anesthesia and airway management techniques may need to be considered to further mitigate the risk of regurgitation.
Thirdly, chewing gum and boiled sweets should be discarded prior to inducing anesthesia to avoid them being inhaled as a foreign body, but do not constitute an indication for delaying any procedure unless they have been ingested. And finally, gastric ultrasound may be considered as a tool to ascertain volume and consistency of gastric contents to guide further management.
So to summarise, the ANZCA fasting guidelines advise that their recommendations may not apply to patients at increased risk of perioperative regurgitation or vomiting, but don't give specific guidance about how these at-risk patients, or specifically patients taking GLP-1 receptor agonists, should be managed. ANZCA has a second publication in combination with the Australian Diabetes Society titled Perioperative Diabetes and Hyperglycemia Guidelines for Adults, and that's worthwhile looking closely at. And again, we've linked this document in our show notes. It's actually a really awesome document that does a great job of clearly laying out how to manage patients with diabetes mellitus perioperatively.
Yes, and as an interesting aside, one of the contributors for this document is Dr. A.B. Lawrence, who's a wonderful anaesthetist from Concord Hospital in Sydney, who was a Deep Breaths guest in Season 2, where she talked about perioperative management of type 1 diabetes. Page 21 of this document addresses the management of non-insulin anti-hyperglycemic medications, and their advice is as follows. Firstly, SGLT2 inhibitors should be withheld for 2 days prior to surgery and the day of surgery. The exception is for minor surgery patients, including day stay, who only need to admit the SGLT2 inhibitor agents on the morning of their procedure. Secondly, all other anti-hyperglycemic medications should be continued up to and including the night before surgery. And thirdly, all non-insulin anti-hyperglycemic medications should be withheld on the day of surgery. The document then continues with the following paragraph, quote, although there are non-insulin medications that may be safe for use through the perioperative period, it is recommended that all non-insulin diabetes medications should be omitted on the day of surgery, including non-insulin injectables for diabetes such as GLP-1 agonists, end quote.
Again, as with the ANZCA PG07 document, the advice regarding what we actually do with patients, beyond advising not to administer this medication on the day of surgery, doesn't really go into specifics. It doesn't tell us if our risk assessment should be adjusted if patients experience adverse effects from GLP-1 receptor agonists, and it doesn't advise us who of these patients are safe to anaesthetise and who should have adjustments to their fasting guidelines, and indeed, what those adjustments should be. Now, it warrants saying that this is actually not a criticism of either of these guidelines. Our knowledge of how GLP-1 receptor agonists affect perioperative fasting and aspiration risk is a shifting landscape, and the body of evidence, though currently not that great, continues to grow with additional research being published regularly. As it stands, there are no studies currently published that specifically investigate the overall risk or benefit that GLP-1 receptor agonists pose to the population taking them. It's really no surprise that there is no concrete advice regarding the perioperative management of patients on GLP-1 receptor agonists.
But there is one professional organisation that has attempted to address how to manage patients on GLP-1 receptor agonists.
That is absolutely correct.
And that is the American Society of Anesthesiologists, which published a press release in June 2023 providing consensus guidelines that specifically detail the perioperative management of both adults and children taking GLP-1 receptor agonist medication. We've provided a link to this consensus-based guideline in our show notes, so be sure to check it out. It's not a very long statement and one that anyone could read in about 5 minutes.
Now, there are a few interesting admissions to make within this document, separate to the advice about perioperative management of GLP-1 receptor agonists. The authors advise that these medications are associated with a series of adverse gastrointestinal side effects, which include nausea, vomiting, and delayed gastric emptying. They also advise a couple of things that I found interesting and that I hadn't really seen formally stated in much of the research I did for this episode. The first was that the presence of adverse gastrointestinal symptoms like nausea, vomiting, dyspepsia, and abdominal distension in patients taking GLP-1 agonists are predictive of increased residual gastric contents. The second is that during the conduct of general anesthesia and deep sedation, children on GLP-1 agonists have similar gastrointestinal adverse events to adults at a rate that is similar to adults. Sadly, though, they didn't specify what this rate was.
It is interesting, and it would have been really interesting if they'd actually published a rate.
Oh, wouldn't that have been nice?
We're going to directly quote the considerations that the authors of this document advise. First, quote, "For patients scheduled for elective procedures, consider the following. In the days prior to the procedure, firstly, for patients on daily dosing, consider holding GLP-1 agonists on the day of the procedure / surgery. For patients on weekly dosing, consider holding GLP-1 agonists a week prior to the procedure or surgery. Secondly, this suggestion is irrespective of the indication, so either type 2 diabetes or weight loss, the dose or the type of the procedure or surgery. And thirdly, if GLP-1 agonists prescribed for diabetes management are held for longer than the dosing schedule, consider consulting an endocrinologist for bridging the anti-diabetic therapy to avoid hyperglycemia."
The second set of recommendations regard what to do on the day of the procedure. First, if gastrointestinal symptoms such as severe nausea, vomiting, retching, abdominal bloating, or abdominal pain are present, consider delaying the elective procedure and discuss the concerns of potential risk of regurgitation and pulmonary aspiration of gastric contents with the proceduralist or surgeon and the patient. Second, if the patient has no gastrointestinal symptoms and the GLP-1 agonists have been held as advised, proceed as usual. Third, if the patient has no gastrointestinal symptoms but the GLP-1 agonists were not held as advised, proceed with full stomach precautions or consider evaluating gastric volume by ultrasound, if possible, and if proficient with the technique. If the stomach is empty, proceed as usual. If the stomach is full or if gastric ultrasound is inconclusive or not possible, consider delaying the procedure or treating the patient as having a full stomach and manage accordingly. Discuss the concerns of potential risk of regurgitation and pulmonary aspiration of gastric contents with the proceduralist or surgeon and the patient. And lastly, there is no evidence to suggest the optimal duration of fasting for patients on GLP-1 agonists. Therefore, until we have adequate evidence, we suggest following the current ASA fasting guidelines. End quote.
So even though this document obviously can't advise on many of the aspects of perioperative management of patients on GLP-1 receptor agonists, it at least gives us a bit of direction about how to approach these patients in the days leading up to and the day of an elective procedure.
Yeah, I agree. So there will almost certainly be more concrete guidelines published on this topic over the next few months to years. So our advice is just to watch this space. Now, I'm curious, Kate, what is your approach to patients taking these medicine? And I mean, have you even had much experience with these patients? Because these drugs certainly aren't terribly widely prescribed at this point.
No, certainly not amongst the patient population that I'm seeing. I've seen a couple of patients on it for diabetic indications, but I can't say I've had a huge amount of experience. How about you?
Look, I have seen a couple of patients come through on it, and to be honest, I have had chats with the pharmacists at the hospital about this, but generally my advice is to withhold the dose before your surgery, whether that be a weekly dose or a daily dose. Certainly, I haven't actually seen anyone on daily dosing SGL-1 agonists.
No.
I've only ever seen weekly dosing, and I routinely just tell people, look, I advise them that these medications can put you at increased risk of aspiration. Mm. We advise to withhold the dose before surgery. And then I also just mention when I see them, this is in the clinic, that if they do have signs and symptoms that could suggest that they have a full stomach, that we may end up delaying them just because it's not worth the risk of aspiration.
Mm.
So I do try to word them up to the fact that they may be postponed. But all going well, hopefully, depending on the duration of action of these medications, hopefully once they get out of the system, and I know that there's pharmacologically it's like 4 to 5 half-lives, I think we have to wait. Hopefully once that has passed and the effects of that medication are no longer occurring in the body, hopefully their risk would go back to whatever it was before they took that medication.
Mm.
But again, this is something that we just don't know. Mm. Like, there's actually not a lot of really good knowledge out there about these medicines because they're so fresh to the market.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we try and do our best and we try and give the most sensible suggestions we can, but the reality is it's always hard to advise on things that you don't really understand and you don't know about, you know?
Yeah, I think you just have to keep pace with you know, new developments and new evidences that it arises and just do the best you can with the current knowledge, really.
Yeah.
So, look, I know we've mentioned gastric ultrasound a few times in this episode. We haven't covered it as part of this topic, but if you're interested in finding out more, we've included some links in our episode notes to articles explaining the basics of gastric ultrasound.
And now, again, we find ourselves at the end of an episode. But before we say farewell, Kate, what have you learned this week in anaesthesia?
Well, it was kind of through a colleague. We had a sort of adverse incident involving some equipment at a hospital, but it was something that shouldn't happen. Patient's fine.
Great.
But when I heard this story, I was like, and I can't really go into specifics, unfortunately, but I was like, this shouldn't happen. You know, like it's just an unusual thing to happen.
Yeah.
And we have recently changed our theatre beds, which was part of this whole thing. Mm. And I had a theory that perhaps we had an equipment problem. And it turns out we do. But the way that my colleague actually sort of solved this problem, and we will be presenting this actually next week to the department, is just testing the hypothesis.
Yeah.
So basically mocked up what had happened with this equipment and discovered the fault. So
wow.
So look, I think I would like to obviously go into more detail. I might have to get some permission from the department before, make sure we've all discussed it first. It's you know, just an interesting case because I think it's easy to say a lot, because I think in a lot of health things it's just, you know, unfortunate or you know, whatever, but I think in this situation to me it was like, this shouldn't, in this setup, this thing shouldn't have happened. And it's quite easy to go and prove that, right, or to test it, and you can test it with staff and do it safely. So I just, I guess, encourage people to not necessarily accept everything as just, well, either someone did something wrong or this. You know, sometimes you need to look at the system and go, okay, let's set this up and see what happens. And you can discover there might be a little fault that you didn't know was there.
Yeah.
And we've certainly uncovered something that we need to now action. So how about you?
Well, it's funny. I was actually going to say something else about what I learned in anaesthesia week, but in this week. But to follow on from what you've said, we're actually having a – we have similar issues – I think all hospitals have similar issues, you know, with equipment problems that may mean that, you know, you're in a situation where you're more likely to fail for whatever reason. And one of the things that we've noticed recently is, and I'm sure this happens to you as well, on a fairly regular basis, pharmacy will change the drug company that stocks certain medications. And so the packaging changes. And something we're finding at the moment is there are two medicines, heparin and protamine, that we use at a major cardiac hospital quite a lot.
Yeah.
But the vials are the same size. They're the same shape. The labels are almost identical. And it's something we've identified that could be a potential issue. You know, the last thing you want to do is to give a patient heparin and give them protamine or vice versa. Like, that could actually end in something bad. And what we're finding is that it's very rare that clinicians are approached and consulted on this change of stockists and the change of packaging and the potential blowback of having that sort of issue arise. And I think it's a great source of frustration for a lot of clinicians, because you don't have that agency in which companies supply medication to you, so you don't have any choice over choosing one particular medicine from one company that looks vastly different to a lot of the others versus something that you end up with that looks the same. So, yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how these things work? And I suppose the learning experience from this is just double check what you're using, what you're drawing up, what equipment you're using. If it's something different to what you're used to, if it's a new drug stockist or a new piece of equipment, just take the time to go over it and make sure that you're happy with it, familiar with it, so that you know and can identify that there could be issues, and maybe try and preemptively identify what they could be.
I mean, you have to, but I think, honestly, I think it's a bit of a system failure.
Absolutely.
Because it's putting the onus on the individual, which we know is not the smartest thing to do, because we're all fallible.
Exactly.
And so our systems should, anyway, it's a little rant, but our systems should probably be set up better to set, you know, set us up for everyone up. It's not just clinicians, you know, our TSOs and other people that work in their theatre setting. It should set everybody up for success.
Absolutely.
And particularly that case of medication. I mean, to me, it's nuts that we don't have an international standard that's based upon colouring. Anyway.
It seems strange, doesn't it? Maybe if there's someone out there that's looking for a research project or something to really sink their teeth into, that could be a topic that's worthwhile.
Yes. Well, yeah, it's just a massive, like, trying to negotiate with private companies, right?
So good luck with that.
Indeed. Well, that's all we have time for on today's episode of Deep Breaths. Don't forget to claim CPD if you are a provisional fellow or consultant. Instructions for this are in our episode notes.
And if you'd like to reach out, you can email us at deepbreathspod@gmail.com with suggestions, questions, or just to say hi. Thanks for listening, and we hope you can join us next time on Deep Breaths.